100 years ago, construction began on the garden suburb of Marino in North Dublin, an early housing scheme in the Irish Free State, which today is a popular residential area with a distinctive appearance. We're going to hear about the history of Marino, an ambitious, idealistic initiative which Dublin Corporation intended to be a model of what good housing should be. But first, our producer, Logan Clancy, went to Marino to find out how residents are planning to mark this centenary.
It's not often that a neighbourhood can boast its own iconic theme song, but thanks to the familiar strains of the Marino Waltz, this community holds a special place in Dublin's collective memory.
John Sheehan grew up in Marino at the corner of St Declan Road and St Declan's Terrace. I met him a number of years ago. I spoke to John and he said he has very fond memories of growing up in Marino. And of course, he wrote the Marino Waltz in tribute to that. And I think we will be incorporating a Marino Waltz as part of our Marino 100 celebrations this year. It's a beautiful piece of music.
That's Mark Crowther, chair of the Marino Residents Association. We met at Carlton Hall, the community hall at the heart of the estate, where the residents gather to make their centenary plans.
It's a very unique place in that it is the first development in the Irish Free State after independence. I know the corporation have been working on other areas to building houses, but this one is recognised as the first one after independence, and it is uniquely associated with the history of the early years of the Irish Free State.
The name Marino dates back to the 18th century, when the first Earl of Charlemont named his residence Marino House, after the town in Italy. Lord Charlemont was also the one who built the famous Casino Marino. In the early 20th century, the area was identified as the ideal location for a new type of housing project with a modern architectural style and large communal green spaces.
You look around Marino now, certainly the first part of developed Marino, which was on the Marino House lands, all the houses are very distinctively very different. Then the corporation kind of ran out of money and simplified the development for the latter half of the estate. But it's still a unique estate with wonderful green spaces. We have two large circles. If you're not from Marino, it takes a long time to get used to how you find your way around the estate. I remember one time my wife telling me she was on a bus coming through Marino when there was still a conductor on it. And she heard the conductor saying to the driver, as they came around the second circle, there was a football match on, and the conductor said, "See, I told you there was two circles in Marino." The driver thought he'd been driving around the same one twice for years.
My name is Patricia Normandly. I'm involved with the Residents Association here. I'm secretary of the Marino Residents Association. People talk today about the concept of the 15-minute city as an urban planning concept. This is a good example of it, that people can walk, go to the local schools, walk to the shops, do all those things without having to jump into cars like a lot of urban areas where people live. We want, I suppose, to celebrate the centenary of Marino, the vision and ambition of Dublin Corporation at the time, who built the estate where we all have the privilege of living now. We want to also celebrate the present and the future of the estate. We had a number of community engagement sessions, workshops, where we invited all the residents to participate in sharing ideas about how it could be celebrated or what they thought was important. So we'll be launching the programme of events on the 18th of May here in the hall. One of the main events in the summer is a midsummer festival in one of our green areas for children, for adults, for everybody. And then a number of history talks throughout the winter.
The association is also developing a heritage trail, a booklet with various maps which will highlight the history, the buildings and the notable people who have lived in the area.
My name is Gerry Edgley. I'm the treasurer of the Marino Residents Association and the Marino and District Community Centre here. People would be interested to know from a historical significance that maybe three of the seven signatories of the 1916 proclamation actually lived around Marino. Tom and Kathleen Clark lived in Richmond Avenue. Thomas McDonough lived in Woodlands, which is just off Phillipsburg Avenue. And Eamon Kant lived in 23 Fairview Avenue itself. Now, apart from that, there were a lot of other people that people would recognise, whether it was James Joyce, Maureen Potter, Rosie Hackett, Kevin Heffernan, Cathal Brühl, and there are others. So we have the individuals, we have the buildings, and then we would have events as well. So each of the maps can be looked at independently and walked independently, or they can be combined. So these will be available via booklet to everybody in Merino and Fairview, and they will also be available online just to get onto merino.ie, and in the future they'll all be there available. It just re-invites people to look at the past, look at where they're living, to be able to appreciate Merino for what it is, and to keep this history alive.
Celebrating our past is very important in terms of how we see ourselves today and how we see the future. Mainly for people going forward in the future to see the value of living in a place like this and as an example of how other communities could live.
Rockin Clancy was reporting there from Merino in Dublin, where residents are marking the centenary of this garden suburb this year. And you can find out more about their centenary plans at merino.ie. I'm joined now in studio by Dr. Ruth McManus from the School of History and Geography at Dublin City University, who has researched the history of this estate. You're very welcome back, Ruth, to the History Show. The concept of a garden city or garden suburb begins to become popular. What was it, kind of end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, there, thereabouts?
Exactly. In fact, the concept was originally devised by a man called Ebenezer Howard, an Englishman, who publishes a book in 1898, which wasn't even called anything about garden cities. It was called Tomorrow, A Peaceful Path to Real Reform.
Doesn't even sound like it's about buildings.
Exactly. But this idea that he had of taking people out into newly built cities, right out, self-sufficient garden cities where everything would be in one place, as a way of escaping from all of the problems of the 19th century city, the overcrowding, the pollution, so on and so forth. But his idea actually took on a life of its own very, very quickly. The first garden city was built in 1903 in Letchworth in England, and there was a subsequent one in 1919. But in the meantime, the people who designed that garden city ended up also designing suburban areas, the most celebrated of which was Hampstead at the edge of London. And their designs for this garden suburb were what really took hold. And that was the idea that came to Dublin then in the 1910s.
So a garden city has everything you need. A garden suburb is, as the name suggests, is adjacent to a larger city, larger urban entity.
It's the difference between being self-contained and being a suburb.
Now, there was a desperate need, obviously, in Dublin for new housing, for quality housing, and that was revealed, you know, people were well aware of the fact, given some of the things that happened, the Church Street disaster, etc., etc. But there was a housing inquiry in 1914. What did that tell the city, the fathers and mothers, about Dublin housing?
Well, the inquiry showed just how desperate the state of housing was, the fact that 13,000 houses were urgently required. The corporation had managed in the previous 30 years to provide a tenth of that figure. There were a huge number of people living, about 20,000 families living in one family tenements. So huge overcrowding, which led to ill health. And that desperate overcrowding, that very poor conditions, but also ability to pay was very limited. So people were restricted in their accommodation and in what they could afford.
I would assume, though, the timing of the report was not great. 1914, there wasn't much opportunity to act upon the findings of the report.
Exactly. In fact, there had been a push really from about 1910 and this whole idea about garden suburbs. There was a huge interest in modern ideas about planning and about housing. The corporation was trying to do things. The report comes out and, of course, then we're into wartime conditions. No construction at all practically takes place. Then, and of course, that continues, persists really for nearly a decade. There was almost no housing. So it was a huge shortage of housing for all classes in society by the time we get to the Free State.
So basically, things are bad in 1914. They have got much worse by the 1920s.
Exactly. There's a huge deterioration.
Give us an idea then of how ambitious the Merino project was, the size of the houses that they were constructing, the facilities available to each of the householders. I mean, it was intended at least to represent a huge jump in standards,
yes.
Wasn't it?
One of the interesting things about Merino is it had been thought about for a very long time. The very first mention of using Merino for housing goes back to 1910. This idea of what they called a miniature garden city. So, and they had actually got so far as to come up with a plan for Merino in 1919. And that couldn't be proceeded with owing to the political conditions, as they put it in the report. So they'd had a couple of runs at designing Merino. And when the final plan comes around, a lot of thought and consideration has gone into it. There's also been an overall new thinking about design and layout of housing coming from Britain really after the First World War. So there was a big report on how the reconstruction of Britain and of housing, which was called the Tudor Walters Report. And that had lots of ideas about housing density and about layout and about having lots more light and air. And all of those things were then adopted in Merino. So one of the things that came out of that new way of thinking was that the houses should be bigger. And that's one of the things we see. All of the houses in Merino had five rooms. Now, not five bedrooms, but five rooms. They all had indoor plumbing, hot and cold water. They all had a scullery. They all had gardens front and rear. It was low density, about 11 houses per acre. The previous schemes that the corporation had built could be 40 or 50 houses to the acre. So there's a lot more space. There's a lot more light. There's a lot. It's considered to be a healthy environment. And of course, that came at a price as well.
So the delay caused essentially by the War of Independence was not necessarily a bad thing. It allowed the planners to get their act together.
I suppose so. It could certainly be argued that way. It also perhaps allowed the costs to come down a little bit because wartime inflation had done terrible things to the cost of building houses.
Now, Merino was intended very much also as a model of good housing, as a template that others could learn from.
Exactly. A Dublin corporation was very insistent on this. And that's why there's a lot of different housing types at Merino, although they all have the same basic number of rooms. For example, the exterior appearance is very varied. There's lots of different building materials used. It doesn't feel like an estate of all the houses being the same. There's lots of variety. The layout, some of the houses are in pairs, they're threes, they're fives, they're eights.
Front and back gardens?
All front and back gardens. Also, there was space for allotments, big also public open spaces in the centre of the scheme. And of course, there was space allowed for shops, there was space for the church and the schools. That was all considered and included in the planning.
Now, we're talking about 1920s Ireland, when we didn't have a Red Rex. We hadn't two halfpennies to rub together, basically. So funding was an issue, wasn't it?
It was a huge issue. And this was where certain things had to be compromised upon. And the government was very clear on the amount of funding and the grant available, that a house could not cost more than £750 all in to build. So I think the first phase in Merino, the houses were £747 to build. So they just about brought them in under the limit. And the corporation was kind of cross about this because it really wanted to do certain things that it couldn't achieve at that money. And that led to certain pragmatic decisions. One of these was that the main frontages, the main roads at the edges of the scheme weren't built directly by the corporation. So they wanted those houses, say, along the Malahide Road and along what becomes Griffith Avenue. They called it the 100-foot road at the beginning, and along Phillipsburg Avenue. They wanted those areas to be even nicer houses. All of the housing was of very good quality, but they wanted these to be a little bit better, to have a better look. And they couldn't do that within the budget. So instead, they reserved those areas and made them available to others to build upon to a certain. So the minimum price of the houses on Malahide Road, say, would be £750, so that they would be in excess of what they could build themselves.
But these are privately built.
And they're privately built. And some of them are built by a builder's guild and some of them are built by a public utility society, which is a kind of a housing co-op. And the good thing about that is that you got a little bit more of a social mix. You got a bit of variety in your housing type. And of course, it was cost neutral to the corporation. So they continue that policy then thereafter. So it turned out to be a pragmatic decision that ended up being a good solution.
And all of this is in the context of something called the £1 million scheme. What was the £1 million scheme?
So when the Free State comes into existence, the government is really keen that something should be done about housing. It's a huge issue right across the country. A lot more attention had been placed on rural housing in the previous 50 years or so. But right across the country, there was a huge need for housing. And as a sort of a marker that they were going to do something, they had this great headline. It's like a great soundbite in today's money, I suppose, that they would give £1 million towards housing, which sounds very dramatic. And of course it was. But at the same time, given the cost of construction, it meant about 2,000 houses scattered across the country. Nevertheless, it was an important first step. And schemes like Fairbrothers Fields, which is now known as the Tenters, and Merino came under this scheme in terms of how they were funded and so on.
Things weren't helped by the fact that there was a strike in 1924. Tell me about that.
Yes, Larkin. Up to no good, I suppose one might say. And yeah, construction stops for, I think, 4 or 5 months, which was hugely disappointing to everybody involved in the scheme. Yeah, it was discussed in the Dáil as well as in the corporation as a huge source of frustration, really, because people felt that they should all be pulling together to make this thing happen.
Now, interestingly, land policy migrates, rural land policy, tenant purchase, in a sense, migrates from rural Ireland to urban Ireland, because these houses were not for rent. They were sold through a tenant purchase scheme.
Yeah. And again, talking about pragmatic approaches, the corporation was trying to deal with a huge problem, as we've already established. They had limited funds, and they also had the ratepayers always getting cross if they started spending too much in housing. They were never able to claw back an economic rent, which was to cover the costs of the housing. So it was always a burden on the rates if you built a new housing scheme. So it was, again, pretty much a pragmatic decision rather than a political one to say, well, we'll actually sell these houses to the tenants. So the houses at Merino, which we already saw cost about £750 to build, were sold over a period of time under tenant purchase scheme at between £400 and £440 per house. But that was felt to be a good idea from a financial point of view. And also then later on, they sort of said, well, that they kind of justified it by also saying, well, it made for good citizens because these people would take care of their houses. They had a vested interest in them now.
And also a lot of these people were moving out of rental schemes, which meant that, you know, rental houses or rental flats or whatever became available.
Yeah. So the Irish Times wrote a little bit scathingly that these houses were only for the aristocracy of the working classes because of the cost. But at the same time, because they vacated tenement houses, it meant that there was more housing there freed up. You know, you could argue whether or not that was really very effective, but that was the same argument that was being made across the board at the time.
And as we go through the 1920s then, is there constant tension, continuing tension between creating good housing and essentially tackling the scale of the overall housing problem, creating any kind of housing?
Yeah, yeah. It's an ongoing issue. How can you balance the need to provide decent housing for the people with the sheer scale of the problem and the affordability question? And this sort of plays out in different ways in different schemes. So Merino is tenant purchase. Then we have Drumcondra is the next really big scheme from to 27, where they compromise again by making some of the houses smaller. So some of them only have 3 rooms in Drumcondra, for example, again for tenant purchase. And then by the late 20s, so by 1929, we see the government stepping in, the Department of Local Government doing a sort of a survey of what is the housing need across the country and saying, well, we're not actually tackling the problem of the slums here, and starting to propose that modified houses are built. So modified, you know, slightly less fancy houses, I suppose, the modified 4-room house became prominent. And then we see a shift from building the tenant purchase houses going back to rental schemes. So in Cabra, we see that switch over point. Half of Cabra was built for tenant purchase and then they switched to rental.
Are we going, you know, the crisis that we're going through today, are we in a position to learn lessons from the Merino project?
I suppose I always say this, the biggest lesson, I think, is that even though we were broke, even though we were in a really terrible position, there was an effort made to do something about the situation. And there was a political will there, even with all of the problems and all of the compromises and all of the criticism that they were faced with, they did something.
Yeah. And now we're not broke.
Exactly.
That's another story for other programmes to discuss. We're the History Show. You have an online exhibition now on all of this called Housing the People, Building the State. Just tell us about that. What's involved with that?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to get some funding from the Royal Irish Academy Decade of Commemorations bursary. And housingthepeople.ie gives the context of all of these schemes and what the Free State was trying to do in that first decade of its existence.
So housingthepeople.ie, if you want to have a look online at what we've just been discussing, that and other projects. We've previously looked on the show at the history of the Tenters, the history of Canester, and now the history of Merino. And all these early housing schemes give an important historical perspective on housing, housing crises, and the value of community as well. My guest is Dr. Ruth McManus of Dublin City University. Ruth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll be hearing about the groundbreaking new project which reveals the full scale of death during the Irish Civil War. Stay with us.